You're on 98.7 FM.
Homegrown
Your story
sounds.
Counts.
Voices.
With Nan and Simone. Welcome, Nan.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good, 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 good. Now, what's the weather?
We're heading from the top of 16 degrees with a little bit of rain.
Oh, I thought we were going to have a thunderstorm today.
Yeah, I love thunderstorms. I love looking out where we live and looking, and we get so many beautiful rainbows, which I sometimes sent you.
Yeah, and to be honest, with all this, you know, all the discussions on equal marriage.
I know.
It's interesting there's been so many rainbows around.
I know.
That's got to be a good sign.
That's right. Exactly. How was your weekend?
Yeah, it was good. It was good. We did the cheerleading thing.
Yeah, that was so cool.
So, yeah, I put it on my post and I have to say people were very supportive of it. So Em's 13 now, so she's got a little bit more kick in her and she can do some amazing things up there, as were so many other kids. So quite eventful. And you know what? I think I'm becoming a fan. It's taken me a while, you know, because more of a netball kid and a softball kid, and suddenly I'm in this cheerleading world. But I'm actually starting to see what it's all about.
You've succumbed.
I have. I have. I'm a fan. Official. It's official. Yeah.
It's worn you down.
Yeah, I need one of those T-shirts now.
Yeah. Okay. What do they say?
I'm a cheerleading mum, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can buy them.
Is it M-O-M though?
Possibly. Oh. Possibly.
No, you got to go for the M-U-M.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's actually, no, I think it is Australian, but they've even got for grandparents as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So hey, how about you? So I assume you guys would have been just working.
Working and getting ready for China.
Ah.
Yeah, so we're going to China. So in a week's time.
Yeah.
So very much looking forward to heading over there.
Is it going
to
be all work or a little bit of play?
Oh, just a little teeny bit of play, but mostly work this time. Training doctors over there in China, so that'll be good. So we've got an exciting show.
We have.
We have Dr. Margie Smith from Smart DNA, author of Gene Genius. Now, I'm very excited because she is a triple threat. Look at your face.
She's a triple threat. What?
Like, she can do so many things.
Yes,
she can do research and development. She can public speak. She can write books. Actually, she's more than a triple. She's a businesswoman, entrepreneur, and she can do anything, really. She can cook. She can make us laugh.
She's incredible.
Actually, that's more. I don't even know how to say that.
It is unbelievable.
The big threat.
Yeah. Well, I think we feel that she is this.
You're on 98.7, Your Story Counts with Simone and Nan. And that was Wonder Woman. And you're heading for a top of 16 degrees. That's just taking me back to my childhood and yours, man.
Absolutely.
We were just bopping in the studio to that. That was just so crazy.
A little lasso and a big high boots.
Yes.
And, oh. And we have her in the studio.
We do. We have. It's Dr. Margie Smith, co-founder of Smart DNA and Gene Genius author. Published author. How are you, Margie?
Great, thank you.
Welcome.
Trepidation living up to Wonder Woman, but we'll see how we go.
So we'll start with your childhood, actually. So you grew up in country New Zealand.
Yes, I grew up in a small farming district in New Zealand, in the South Island of New Zealand, just south of Christchurch, a little place called Geraldine.
Right. How was that growing up? Was it...
Oh, it was great. It was a very carefree childhood. I was a bit of an outdoors kid, so you know, lots of time walking neighbours' dogs or going up the river and building tree huts or going swimming. It was 5 cents to go for a swim after school, so I was a pretty outdoorsy sort of kid.
Did you do science sort of? Were you interested in science way back then? Like, did you do little experiments in the backyard or? You know, pretend to operate on the family dog or cat or anything like that?
I didn't know it was called science when I was growing up, when I was really little, but I was always interested in nature, so looking at bugs or insects.
Did you have one of those bug catchers?
Oh, actually, that's actually quite a traumatic story. I wanted a bug catcher for Christmas.
Yes.
And that was all I wanted was
a
bug catcher.
Yeah, we all had one. Yeah, bug catcher.
And so I asked Santa Claus for a bug catcher, and Christmas morning, like, I opened up my pillowcase because that was where everything went.
Yeah.
And there was no bug catcher.
Oh,
and there
no.
was a note from Santa telling me that they'd been so popular, these bug catchers, that mine was sort of on back order with the elves.
And, cute.
Yeah, I was really disappointed I didn't get my bug catcher. And the other one was those sea monkeys. Do you remember those sea monkeys? But in my mind's eye, as a kid, I thought they were like little monkeys that actually swim around in the water. And you'd actually get to have them. So I was really disappointed when I saw these little things sort of, I don't know, just switching around that didn't really look like monkeys. I thought that was misadvertising.
Yeah, yep, that was.
For about the age of five.
So you started asking
And that's where
questions.
You found your mission.
You started asking questions then.
I think that I had that sort of inquiring mind, a very annoying inquiring mind, to the point where my father was a little bit irate one day and he asked me to stop asking why. I was never, ever, ever to ask why ever again.
Right.
Okay. So that was really difficult because I was quite rebellious.
Yeah.
I was always asking why. I was always questioning things like, you know, not even sciencey things, but when you get married, why did mum have to take your name? Why couldn't she keep her own surname?
Yes. Wow. Very forward thinking.
Well, I can imagine why. Then your dad's like, okay, enough now.
Yeah, enough. Yeah.
That's a question for the future.
So I don't think I would have defined myself as a scientist per se then. I was just a kid with a really inquiring mind and was asking why things were the way they were or trying to find out. I knew about pretty much every animal on the planet.
You would have been a fascinating kid to bring up. I just think that's awesome. I know some of my kids in the clinic are like that. And I just find them amazing. They come in and they look at every aspect of the clinic. You know, they've assessed it all in 5 minutes, pulled out every book, you know, moved every crystal, moved the table around, got into my cupboard.
Yeah.
You know, they just have this innate seeker system, don't they, where they just want to understand.
And you used to read a lot.
Yeah, used to read a lot. But I was also... I was the only child at home for 3 years because, you know, it's just mum, dad, myself. And even to the point where if I had toys out, the rule was I had to put them away. So I always put them away. I didn't draw on any of my books. I didn't draw on any of the walls at home. So it was kind of like I understood that there were rules and there were certain things you just didn't do.
Perfect child, really.
Oh, no. No, because I ended up being quite a rebel, so no.
And you had a favourite toy that you got?
Oh, you mean Harry?
Well, you had Harry, but I was thinking more about the microscope.
Oh, the microscope. Oh, sorry. Yeah. I didn't have a doll. I had a pet monkey. Well, not a pet monkey. A pet monkey called Harry. And, so that was me. But my microscope, okay. So that was the first thing I ever brought myself, was a microscope. And that really allowed me to see the world in more detail, which was really exciting. So you could see a leaf on a tree, but when you managed to put that underneath a microscope, you could see a lot more detail. You could see the cells, you know, onion skin. That was a pretty popular one to put on a slide and pop underneath the microscope, put a bit of iodine on it, you know.
See, I would never have thought to do that as a kid.
No, not at all. It's just fascinating, isn't it? So you just, it's like you just arrived with this inquisitive mind, you know, that was challenging the world.
Well, challenging my parents.
And the interesting thing is you were born Margaret Jean Smith and she's a Jean Smith.
Yeah.
Like how weird is that?
Totally.
She's totally living.
You had no choice. You
to
know
a
that.
Name.
Something deeply psychological going on there.
Yeah.
So if you actually wanted to be something else, it would have been quite difficult.
That's right. It would have been quite challenging.
Because it's just, nope, come back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep, it's in your genes.
It's in your genes. All right. So then what happened? So did you sort of really get into your study or were you sort of...
Yeah, so look, I grew up in this very small farming district. Mm-hmm. So there weren't a lot of opportunities in Geraldine for work after you left school. You could work at the post office and there's nothing wrong with that. Some of my friends did that. But because I was really at that point, you know, focus more on science. I really loved English and creative writing as well, but I needed to have a career path and I recognised that really early on. If I wanted to get out of Geraldine and have a life and a career, I needed to study hard. So I actually really like school. I used to sometimes stress at school when we had to bring our homework out and I couldn't remember whether I'd done it or not, and to my relief I'd always done it, but, you know, there was homework... So homework, school homework and sport were really, you know, how I got through my teenage years.
Yeah, because you're quite a good swimmer too. You did competition swimming.
I did competition swimming and I played representative hockey.
Mm.
So yeah, look, I really love sport, and that's part of the carefree aspect. And I think it was a really good balance, like working really hard at school, but I also had playtime and had time for fun and, you know, catching up with friends. That was always important as well.
Mm. So you've chosen a song, and I love this one from Crowded House, taking the weather with you. Weather with you, Crowded House. You're on 98.7 Your Story Counts with Nan and Simone. We're heading for a top of 16 degrees. So, Miss Margie, what sort of made you choose the science route?
Okay, because I always had that inquiring mind.
Yeah.
So that was, it seemed like a kind of natural fit, my love of nature, animals, just trying to understand more at a cellular level, more detail about health and also disease states.
Yeah.
And then I think really a very big driver for me was I had a sister, Jennifer. She was born with spina bifida. Mm-hmm. And I remember Dad coming home from the hospital after Mum had given birth. And, you know, I was really excited to find out if we have a brother or a sister. And, you know, Dad said, we've got a sister, but she's not well.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big shock to me, because I think there's this expectation for everybody that when you have a sibling, a newborn, that they're just going to be well.
Yeah.
You know, everything's okay.
Yeah.
And it wasn't okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was quite a shock.
Yeah.
And that we had this sick child. And it ended up that Jennifer, we found out, she was born with spina bifida. Mm-hmm. And so it's a neural tube defect. So her spine wasn't formed properly. So she was paralyzed from the waist down. And really, I would say, you know, that was such a significant point in my life, because I was, you know, a young girl, you know, around the age of 8. And I was the eldest child.
So you had all the responsibility.
So it was a lot more responsibility. Yeah. You know, I grew up quite quickly. I think I was a lot more mature for my years. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just how it was. And then 18 months later, my brother was born, and he also had a neural tube defect. So there was another one of the same. So in my inquiring mind, there had to be something wrong with my parents. Which I actually suggested to them that there might be something wrong, that we now have two children in our family with this problem. And years later, I found out that I've got spina bifida occulta. So I've also got a vertebra there that's neither Arthur or Martha. This causes a few little problems. But yes, my parents were not very impressed, suffice to say, that I suggested that to them. But it was such a significant thing that, you know, my sister had a quite severe spina bifida. She died when she was 4 and a half. I was 12 then. So it's a very significant time in your life. And it really, I think, shaped the direction of the kind of science that I wanted to get involved in, because I felt that there was something wrong at a genetic level.
Mm.
And I really wanted to get to the bottom of that.
Yeah.
And we now know what that problem is. It's, you know, it's a vitamin B issue, and very, very common changes to the MTHFR gene.
Mm.
So, you know, and it took me a while to sort of fit into that genetics area. I did a whole lot of other sciencey type jobs before then.
Mm.
But ultimately, I think that was my driver to get into genetics and understand a lot more about it. And ultimately, more around a nutritional sense rather than just the diagnostic area that I moved into.
Wow.
Yeah. Tough story, hey? But again, I guess the resilience in that is that inquiring mind.
Mm.
You know, it was a burning desire to understand why.
Yeah, I think it, you know, probably coupled with that, it's like, why did that happen to our family? Why did Jennifer die? You know, and it's very hard when you're 12 to try and have a philosophy or some kind of spiritual belief that makes that okay, because it's very hard to make that that story okay.
Mm.
So yeah, it had a very profound effect, and I'm sure that there are many, many people out there that are listening that have taken up a career or taken some course in their life because of something that happened in their childhood.
So
if you sit and think about that, It might just suddenly hit you today that, oh, that's probably why I made those choices that I made.
And yeah.
I'm certainly not unhappy with the choices that I made. I've really enjoyed the path that I've taken through science. Sometimes it sort of felt like some of the parts of science didn't really fit together, but then I'd go to another job and be thankful that I'd actually learned some other skill sets in another area.
Mm. So it just comes back to that same thing of some good things can come out of tragedy. Mm. Doesn't all have to be doom and gloom.
Mm. And I think that's our inherent evolution, isn't it? That we do have that ability to say, well, okay, this has happened. What are we going to do with it?
Mm.
That's that incredible human resilience.
Yeah.
And look how many people you have helped.
Yeah.
You know, out of that really difficult time, you know, that 12-year-old kid, look what that 12-year-old kid's done.
Yeah, that's really
you know,
cool.
And which we want to get into sort of further down, you know, the interview.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so tell me more about the sort of, you know, the study and because, you know, you've achieved amazing things. You're very humble.
Yes.
But you have spent quite a few years in the books.
Yeah.
Quite a few years in the books, that's right. Well, I mean, look, I did a whole lot of jobs. My first job was actually working at Fisheries Research in Wellington.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told when I was having the interview there were 300 applicants and 3 vacancies, so don't get your hopes up. But mm-hmm. I'd taken along some school books from biology and something we'd done with the natural ecosystem along the coastline, and I happened to pick a fish that one of the scientists there who was interviewing me was his favourite fish, so I thought, oh, I've got to be in with a good shot here. Anyway, I was lucky enough to be taken on as a trainee, and it was as a seagoing technician.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in the interview saying, now remember, this is not like Jacques Cousteau. So anyone around my age will remember that Jacques Cousteau was a French oceanographer. He's very famous. He did lots of wonderful shows on TV, which I watched avidly. So I thought, oh, just pulling my leg, it has to be exactly like Jacques Cousteau. It's going to be fantastic. So I was put onto the James Cook, our research vessel, and we went down the west coast of the South Island of New Zealand in the wintertime. My porthole and with the cabin that I was in kept going under the water every time the James Cook rolled. It had this horrible corkscrew motion in the water. Mm. I had taken some sea legs tablets with me, so I was basically eating them every day, and because they made me quite sleepy, another cabin member, crew member, gave me some no-dose tablets to keep me awake. So it wasn't the best experience.
Mm, yeah. So you spent a lot of time feeding the fish.
I did spend a lot of time feeding the fish. And then on a subsequent trip that actually was taken into Akaroa. I was on the other coast of New Zealand, just taken into Akaroa.
That's and a pretty town.
It's very pretty, very pretty. I caught a bus out of there and flew from Christchurch Airport back to Wellington. I was told never ever to step foot on the James Cook again because it took time out of their research to get rid of me because I was not recovering from my seasickness. So
you actually got a scholarship.
I got a scholarship, that's right, to go to, come to Melbourne, Melbourne Uni.
It's a big leap from living in New Zealand, a beautiful country, coming to Australia.
Yeah, so I mean, I did that around the age of 30, so I wasn't, you know, 20 or something like that. I did it a little bit later on in life. But my other skills that I'd gleaned or garnered along the way, I used to work in private pathology labs to fund the extra money that I needed to live while I was here in Melbourne. So I did a PhD on early onset Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fantastic experience because I developed a test for detecting early onset Alzheimer's. And I started off looking at half frozen hemispheres of brain tissue in a minus 70 freezer.
Wow.
And that was working with Professor Colin Masters. And I designed my experiment on the first day. I walked along to the freezer to lift the lid on it. It's about 7:30 in the morning. I was so excited to be doing this first experiment. And Colin walked along the corridor and he said, Margie, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm just about to start my first experiment. I've designed it all. The primers are in. It's all good to go. I'm just going to get some brain tissue out. And as he moved along beside me, he put his hand on the top of the freezer and he closed the lid. And he said, I just want you to remember one thing in all of this. And I said, what's that, Colin? What do you want me to remember? He said, every half frozen hemisphere of brain tissue that's here in this freezer has a living family member, and they want to know what you're going to find.
Wow.
So I thought, well, that really makes it very real. You know, I need to be incredibly respectful of my findings. I can't just see it as someone's donated some brain tissue, because there are other people connected to this donation. And and the funny thing that happened was that the first 9 pieces of brain tissue that I picked were the only 9 that had a mutation. So my whole 5-year PhD I could have had done in a year if I'd known it, but I kept going through the freezer and looking to see if we could find mutations. But that was a fantastic experience because I got to work with genetic counsellors, psychologists, psychiatrists, neurologists, so a whole group of professional people who were involved in working with these families. And it made me a more well-rounded scientist, whereas I first went in and I found a mutation. I thought, great, now we'll get every family member tested and that will fix up my family pedigree that I've got drawn here and that'll be fantastic. And then I got the news that not everyone wanted to be tested. And I mean, so, you know, I said, what do you mean they don't want to know? Why don't they want to know? And after speaking with everyone else that was involved, I got to see that there's a much bigger picture to this. It's a person's right to know or not to know. Some people intrinsically want to know, they want to make plans for their future, and other people really, they don't want to have to deal with that news. So I got to understand a lot more about human beings and how they function and just families and what can happen in families. So it was really very insightful.
It's just fascinating.
I know.
Wow. And how old were you when you started this?
Around the age of 33.
Yeah, 33. Fantastic. And it is interesting, isn't it? Because we think, well, we've got the answer.
Yeah.
You know, we laugh about it amongst our tribe. It's like, we've got the answer. But that doesn't necessarily mean that people want to receive the answer.
Exactly. They're not ready to, or they don't want to.
That's right. I mean, and
it's just a big assumption, isn't it? That because we've worked it out, it's not about the fact that everyone else is ready to work it out.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, people in those families will recognise that there's that issue going on, a little bit like with my sister Jennifer and my brother, that there was that issue going on. You don't necessarily know what's causing it. And then so people in that situation with early onset Alzheimer's, and we're talking like the earliest person was 30 years of age. More commonly was around the age of 40 to 50.
That's right.
To be, you know, diagnosed or to actually keep being diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's without actually knowing why. So other family members often live their lives expecting to develop those symptoms around the age of 40 or 50. So it meant they made major life decisions, maybe not to get married, maybe not to buy a house.
Not to have children.
Not to have children because they believed that they were going to go down the same path. So you can imagine if you actually then found out that you didn't inherit the mutation.
You'd be pretty upset.
You would have. There would be another set of circumstances to look at.
To deal with.
And
to
unpack. Manage.
So fascinating. Just one more thing. So then you headed up the Royal Melbourne Hospital Molecular Genetics Lab?
Yes.
Cancer genetics?
I hadn't quite finished writing up my PhD. In fact, I hadn't. I'd just published some papers and was asked to apply for a job at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. And was fortunate enough to get that job heading up the molecular genetics lab. So that was looking at breast cancer genes, other rare heritable cancers. And once again, you know, I was working with a great bunch of folks, genetic counsellors and oncologists, and having very much that team approach. And that's really important to me because I don't think anyone ever does anything as a singular event. There's always other people involved, and especially in that medical arena, you need that expertise. You need all those facets to come together to really help people manage the news that they are receiving.
Yeah, and you were looking at hardcore genetics too.
Very hardcore. Sometimes.
Like BRCA.
Yeah, breast cancer genes.
Bowel cancer. Yeah.
Yeah, TP53, which was called leframini. I don't know who names these disease states, but anyway. So yes, so that more families that where there's just a lot of cancer. So, you know, there's it's quite a a big area to be working in, but it's also really important. And I felt at that time I was making a contribution and really helping working with a team of people. So
excellent. So now we have Someone Like You from Van Morrison. Someone Like You, Van Morrison. You're on Your Story Counts with Nan and Simone. And in the studio, we have Dr. Margie Smith, co-founder of Smart DNA and published author of Gene Genius. Now, Margie, we met a long time ago, 2001, I think it was, at a business networking event. And from there, I then approached you in 2009 to see if you had any interest in or did you know anything about nutrigenomics.
Yeah, I was really shocked that you were asking me that question because it was such an exciting, burgeoning area at that time. It was pretty leading edge. And I said, yeah, that's fantastic. Really love to know more about that. Yeah. And you responded with?
I said, well, I've got an idea. Because what was happening for me, I was doing business coaching and couple coaching, life coaching, and it was just a fee for service. And I wanted to be able to create something that really helped people on a global scale and something that could be sold while you're sleeping. And so together we set up Smart DNA in Australia.
Yeah, and that it really played with my mind, that kind of concept more of preventative health, because remember I've been working in the area of diagnostics and disease. So you kind of turned it all around in terms of, hey, this is something that we can do where we look at DNA and what you've inherited from mum and dad, but more from the perspective of what dietary changes can I make, what particular supplements, what kind of exercise I can do that's going to be good for me. So it was more preventative, personalized health. But then I suppose in another way, like when you look at our cardiovascular panel, it's also for people who have a cholesterol profile that might not be quite what they want it to be, but then how do they fix that? What can they do in a more personalized approach to get a cholesterol profile that looks a little bit better?
Yeah, because our current cholesterol profile doesn't work. You don't see the very things that actually kill you.
That's a problem. So cardiologists pretty much globally ask for a test that would measure the components of a cholesterol profile in the human body. The only problem with that fundamentally is that that cholesterol profile doesn't measure small, dense LDL. So you will have seen on your cholesterol profile something called HDLs, sort of good cholesterol, and then you've got LDLs. But they are only the types 1 and 2. Nature actually made 7 types, 3 through to 7 are the really nasty, small ones that are atherogenic and cause plaques and so on. So it seems a little bit fundamentally unfair that we make assumptions about your health when we don't actually in that test measure the really nasty part of the profile. So I think it's really important when you get a test done that you ask, what will this test show me and what will it not show me? So that you're really clear on what the parameters of any test are that you get done and how you're actually going to manage that for your health, because no test is everything to everybody. It's one single test. You really need to bring it together. I mean, you know, hospitals separate out our body into heart or liver or kidney, really when you look at a human being, it it functions together. It's a very holistic functioning. You know, so you can't really just separate something out like that without looking at everything in a context. And even today, we look at cardiovascular health and we even take into account the bacteria in our gut. So who knew that poo in our gut, our microbiome, can have an impact on heart health as well. So everything's connected. Everything's connected in nature. Everything's connected in a human being.
Yeah.
It's a bit like an orchestra, isn't it? You know, when all the sort of instruments are all playing together and harmoniously, it sounds amazing. But just having one musician not quite performing on the night can interfere with the sound for everyone. And the body feels a little bit like that, doesn't it?
Well, you've actually got an example of the Christmas tree as an example of Christmas lights.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So this is the... So I was going to say, with what Nanette was saying, you know, we want to be our own conductor and look after our vehicle that we're in, our body. But at a cellular level, coming back to my microscope kind of theme, if you want to really drill down at a cellular level, there's a process called methylation. Mm-hmm. And that turns genes on and off. Because a little bit like your analogy with the orchestra, you know, you don't want to have the person on the percussion, you know, making that noise the whole time. You want to be able to shut them off. And it's a little bit like that with genes. They need to be turned on and off in the right sequence. Otherwise, you're going to be producing, you know, too much of a particular enzyme or protein. And, you know, that's not going to be helpful to your body. So methylation is like the conductor, and it turns genes on and off. So when people don't methylate well, it's a little bit like the lights on a Christmas tree. There might be, some might be jammed on, some might be off, and you really just want them to be synchronous and be coming on and off at the right time. So,
got it.
You know, and that's where nutrition can play.
What a great analogy.
Yeah, well, you started it.
Yeah. But no, it's just great because it does become so overwhelming for people. I think, you know, if you don't understand the body, you know, if you don't live, breathe it every day as a practitioner, you know, suddenly, you know, your first experience of understanding that that, you know, orchestra is not working so well is, you know, the doctor's, you know, and hearing, hey, you've got some big news, and then you go to Dr. Google.
That's right, exactly, which is
and
disturbing.
Then your journey begins.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So everything that with in relation to the genomic wellness test that we created, everything we look at, you can do something about through nutrition, supplementation, or lifestyle interventions. So, you know, you only need to have the test done once. That your DNA doesn't change, but the epigenetics, the pathology, can measure, you know, shifts in your, you know, in your body to be able to see whether the interventions you've made have made a difference.
Yeah, I mean, I used to be a runner. I was very much a racing sardine. I used to run 10Ks every day. And if I'd known that I have a very pro-inflammatory gene profile, in fact, I probably should have thought about it a little bit more if I looked at my grandmother. She had terrible problems with inflammation, with osteoarthritis and so on. So there's a really good pointer. If you really want to understand a little bit about your genome, look to your parents and your grandparents for some pointers, just to really know about your family in that sense. But I basically wore out my knee joints running, and that's frustrating now. But I do have ways that I manage that inflammation and dial it down through nutrients. And that's really, really helpful because I don't have pain, and it improves my mobility now. So that's great. Just, you know, walking. I'd love to be able to go running again. It's exhilarating. But
you like doing that, Nan, don't you, running?
Yeah, I love to run. I totally get that. I mean, it's quite addictive, and it just clears your mind.
Wish
so it would
I
be
had
difficult
that.
if that's what worked for you. And then your genetics sort of slow you down in that way.
And that's true. I mean, you know, it is addictive. It is a form of addiction. So when we talk about addiction, you know, we always think about drugs or alcohol, that type of thing, rather than healthful things. Because, you know, when we go running, we release endorphins, but there's also dopamine, all those really good feel-good hormones are being released. And just remember, everybody who's listening, your brain is addicted to feeling good. It wants to feel good. It will get you to do things repetitively that make it feel good. So running can be one thing. Particular foods can be another. Certain food cravings are all about your brain asking you in a very surreptitious way for perhaps the building blocks of dopamine or serotonin. But it comes in the form of some processed pastry, which momentarily makes you feel good, and then you feel flat again because you've eaten something that you don't feel good about. So,
Is that people as well? Do you know how some people just, you know,
addicted to the
you're
same
just
person.
Addicted to people? Do you know?
What do you mean?
Well, you know, some people they just go, oh, that person makes me, you know, when you've been in a marriage, say for, you know, 30 odd years, and then suddenly you meet this person and they rock your world and your brain just wakes up and you just, you know, you just don't know what to do with yourself. You know, is that the same sort of
thing? Are you talking about the love nerve growth factor?
Are you talking about being in love?
I guess it is, yeah.
Yeah, so being in love.
Could be in lust.
It might be. So in genetic terms, and this is really going to destroy what being in love is for people, so maybe just cover your ears and go la 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 for a couple of minutes while I say this if you don't want to hear it. So when we're in love, our brain pumps our nerve growth factor. And this massive amount of nerve growth factor makes us a little bit edgy. We can't stop thinking about that person. We might stop eating. We might start eating a lot more. But nerve growth factor... Now, that keeps being produced in your brain for about 12 months. So generally, being in love lasts up to about 12 months. Mm. And then the real love, as I call it, begins. So
I love that first part.
The first 12 months.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah, I'm addicted to it. The first 12 months is, though, where you love them whistling in the car beside you. And then after 12 months, it's really just annoying.
Really
can
annoying.
You be can quiet? You stop now? Yeah. Stop breathing, yeah. Stop actually.
So I'm not saying that genes are responsible for everything, because there's also our environment, there's also our upbringing, there's a whole lot of things.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned about the environment. So, I mean, that's one thing that I changed when I got my DNA done, is that I had really poor detoxification pathways. So I had to eliminate all chemicals, even perfumes and, toothpaste. Well, I use a green toothpaste, not green colour, but it's a healthy one.
Got that.
and removing all chemical cleaning products from your home, just get a cleaner in to do that instead. But it really helped me once I had that, and I actually then, had the brain fog, and I then got supplementation for that, and I didn't have brain fog anymore. Like, just little tweaks like that has made such a difference to my health.
Yeah, so food and good nutrition, coupled with understanding what your genome is like, how it's constructed, are really important steps to preventative health.
Yeah.
And I think that's key. I mean, what Simone is talking about are two enzymes called GSTT1 and GSTM1. Now, both of them are deleted. So it's sort of like the last bastion where you get to blame your parents if you're not happy with your genome.
Not happy, mummy.
Not happy. But those particular genes, when they are deleted, they're not present. Really need to make sure you're also meeting your daily recommended intake for vitamin C. It's absolutely critical. So remember, all the recommended daily intakes for nutrients are based on a standard population. It doesn't take into account your unique genetics. So for people like Simone, really vitamin C every day is really very important.
I go to the ocean and get vitamin C, SEA. That's what I do. So the other test that we created that we've had for a few years now is our Smart Gut Microbiome Test.
Yeah, so we've developed a method for looking at bacteria in your microbiome, and that's really important because so many people have gut issues like IBS. It's really, really common. And we've developed parameters for all the major bacteria found in the microbiome. And, surprisingly, maybe not surprisingly, 50% of your gut bacteria are determined by your diet. Mm. So you can make a really positive impact on your gut microbiome. And one of the things that's missing from our diet is fiber. We need a lot more fiber, okay? Mm. And especially resistant starch type fiber, because that stops that leaky gut. Bacteria produce metabolites, some of them are nasty toxins, and that can really, not surprisingly, affect our brain. So there's that a gut-brain axis where your gut talks to your brain and your brain talks to your gut. You're not included in that conversation, but you get to feel the effects of it if it's not good. So,
and what are some of the symptoms you can experience if they're not talking that well?
If they're not talking that well, well, it's like any relationship. It's not good. It can give you a pain in the head. It can give you a pain in the gut. It can make people feel anxious, depressed.
Grumpy.
Yeah, so it has major impact. So they both influence each other. Mm. So you really
which
want
which in the end is quality of life.
And it can affect skin, you know, like your skin. Full potential.
Oh, I mean, people who have fixed up their gut microbiome who've got it out of it. It's called dysbiosis, this very unbalanced state, back to a more normalized state. They've found even with certain nutraceuticals that psoriasis has been totally removed from individual skin, like it just repairs itself with the right nutrients. There are so many problems with our modern day diet. I can't even begin to start now, but please just think about B vitamins, omega-3s, vitamin D. And just because you're out there in the sun doesn't mean that you're getting your daily dose of vitamin D. Your pathway may be genetically affected. So.
Mm. Yeah, very interesting.
All right, we've just got a couple of community announcements and we'll be back in 1 minute.
You're on Your Story Counts with Nan and Simone, and in the studio we have Dr. Margie Smith. And now, you wrote a book called Gene Genius. I remember seeing you locked in that room, typing away for days on end.
I know. It was a very structured process.
Yes.
It wasn't like my love of creative writing, as I mentioned before. It had to start at the absolute beginning. I thought I'd pick a chapter on a particular topic. I found out from the editors that wasn't acceptable. I had to start at the beginning and build the storyline. So,
When you're dealing with a publisher, it's a whole new ball game. It's different to being self-published.
That's right. Well, I hadn't been self-published before, so I was straight into it, into the deep end.
Yeah.
And but it was good because it really meant that I had to be engaging with the public and write something that was going to be of interest and easily understood. There's no point in writing something if people can't understand it. So that was really a good challenge to have. So I nicknamed some of the genes.
Yep.
So there's the sweet tooth gene for mm-hmm. people who get addicted to sugar. There's the fatso gene, which I have two copies of. So if anyone has problems with eating and gaining weight very quickly, here's a couple of quick pointers. Protein with every meal. Exercise will give you much better control of leptin.
Yes, that's one of the issues, isn't it?
A hunger hormone that gets produced. So go out and exercise because you'll find that it will basically give you epigenetic control of that hormone, and you won't be overeating. And you want low GI fruits and vegetables, nothing processed. Okay. So as a kid with my two copies of the fatso gene, which I didn't realize, every time we go for a Sunday drive and we go past little stores in the countryside, my comment from the back seat would be, they sell hot pies in there. They've got hot pies in there, mum and dad. I love a hot pie. I was addicted to pies.
And cakes.
And cakes. And so that's a fatso gene thing. It makes you, it's really strange, isn't it? But this gene, if you've got it, people go for energy dense foods, and it's not a good thing. So I did lose a lot of weight during my teenage years once I discovered that food contained energy and there are different amounts of energy. And so I really altered my whole regimen for eating. So just if you have that issue, there's some really good pointers.
Yeah, this book, Gene Genius, is wonderful for that self-reflection, isn't it? It gives you those aha moments to go, oh, my, it's not my fault. But also some constructive ideas on what you can change and why you behave in a certain way. And it's not necessarily always free choice. It is something that you've inherited and what to do about it. A number of my clients have read it and they've all really enjoyed it. It is worth, you can download it, can't you, or buy it.
Yeah, you can buy it on our website, smartdna.com.
Yeah, I'd just like to say, you know, when it comes to weight management, because it's quite a big issue, just really need to change your consciousness, because it's actually not you being weak-willed per se, but it's your brain is going to nag you for things. So you have to understand that it's got its own set of priorities, which are not yours. So you really need to harness your brain and focus on yourself and make those really good choices for you. So once you have that epiphany that alters your consciousness and awareness, then I think you've got a much better chance of being able to manage your life and your lifestyle.
And that's what this information does. It's like another level of getting to know yourself And you can tell a lot, you know, even it's even got a bit of a personality profile to it as well, our testing. So it is a very powerful tool to be able to take charge of your health and taking a preventative approach, because not one size fits all. And there's so many diets out there that, you know, being promoted that are not necessarily good for you.
Rather than, and that's it. You want to set yourself up for success, don't you?
Yes, yeah.
But, yeah, and obviously your testing is incredible. I mean, you have done amazing things, Margie, you know, since you've been on the planet. You know, your testing that has been validated, tried and tested, and they're now sort of being utilised by practitioners all over the world.
Yeah.
And so that people can find out this information. Practitioners can also do a better job because they can actually get the information that they need and then prescribe supplements or lifestyle or whatever it is that person needs that is totally tailored to that individual. So that's an incredible feat.
It is, and it's like an additional tool for a practitioner's toolbox. It's not the answer to everything, but it certainly fast-tracks them to actually get to the bottom of some challenging issues that their patients might have. So that's why it's very exciting. It's the way of the future, and it's here now. We can have better health now.
Is it simple to actually get one of those tests
done? Yeah, to spin in a tube.
Is that
so? Basically, we can all do that. That's right. We don't deal direct to the public, but you can contact us, and we can certainly refer you to a practitioner in your area to be able to go through the results. It's a 100-page report, but don't be overwhelmed by that. It's just a lot of information for those who may want more information, or we just give them the answer in there anyway. So it's very exciting.
So we would love to give away Margaret Smith's book, Gene Genius, to anybody that would like to comment on Your Story Counts. It's RPP, Your Story Counts. Jump on Facebook, and if you can put a comment in there, then we will pick a name and we'll send out a book to you.
Yeah.
So it's definitely one. It's a bit of a Bible.
Yep.
It's one that you want to have there and just, you know, pick up from time to time or read it back to front.
Yeah, signed copy.
Well, we've loved having you on. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Maggie.